I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. In hundreds of years, when people read the history of the 21st century, they may well call it the era of urbanization, the century in which hundreds of millions of people, billions ultimately, left their homes in rural areas and crowded into cities, looking for new and better lives. But how will that migration affect the planet? Karen Seto, Associate Professor of the Urban Environment at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, argues that the impact may be profound. Karen Seto, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Kara.
So I want to ask you, how is urbanization different now than it was, say, 100 years ago, which was also a time in many places of rapid urbanization?
Well, there are two main ways in which urbanization today is fundamentally different from urbanization from 100 years ago. Actually, three main ways in which urbanization today is different from 100 years ago. One is simply the scale of urbanization. So cities today are bigger than they ever have been in history. We have cities like Tokyo, Yokohama that are more than 20 million in size, also like in Mexico City. We've never had cities of that size before. And at the same time, we've never had the sheer numbers of cities that we have in the past. So currently we have 19 megacities around the world. So these are cities with 10 million or more. We also have more than 400 cities worldwide with a population of a million or more. So that's fundamentally different than in the past. The rate at which urbanization is occurring, the rate at which people are moving into cities, the rate at which the planet is becoming more urban in the landscape is also fundamentally different. And then the third big difference is where this urbanization is happening. 100 years ago, urbanization was primarily occurring in North America, in Europe, and also in Latin America. But in the 21st century, it's really a century about urbanization in Asia, and primarily in China and India, and also in parts of Africa. So from a global perspective, what we have in the U.S. are really their mid-sized cities. Many of the cities in the U.S. are actually smaller cities by global standards. And certainly when you go to Asia, China and India, you'll see that, you know, the cities in the United States are significantly smaller in comparison.
So we've got 7 billion people on the planet right now. The projection is by 2030, which is not actually that far off, that 5 billion people are going to live in cities. What is driving people to get out of the rural areas that they're in and squish themselves into, you know, cities of 10, 15, 20 million people?
Well, the big answer to that, the main factor, driving force, is really economic opportunities. Really around the world, cities are nodes of economic, of development, of economic opportunities, of jobs, education opportunities. And we're seeing that that's really a big draw for people all around the world. But it's not just economic opportunities. It's also different policies in different countries. So for many years, China had policies that really kept people out in the countryside, had a really deliberate de-urban or anti-urban policy, a really pro-rural policy. And in the last 30 years, we've seen a fundamental shift in China, much more policies towards urbanization, really looking at cities as engines of economic development. And we're seeing a very similar type of shift in policy in India as well. And so these are two urban giants where the population is migrating into cities because of economic opportunities, but also because of really fundamental shifts in policy. And in Africa, we see very different patterns of urbanization, you know, very different push factors, people being pushed off farms. Again, it's also economic opportunities, but not in the same way that we see in China and India.
Do you think the governments of China and India worry at all that if they push everybody or many, many people into cities and lure them, as you said, with a kind of both economics but also policies, that there won't be enough people left to actually grow the food for the people living in the cities?
Well, in both China and India's case, they have a long way to go before they have a small percentage of the population in the countryside. Despite the fact that, I mean, I don't know if you've been to China lately, but despite the fact that it seems like all of China's population lives in the cities, in fact, that isn't the case. China's population, there's still a significant number of the population that lives in the countryside. What we're going to see in China's case is that its urban population will peak somewhere in the first half of the 21st century. By 2050, its population or its urban population will be about 77%. In contrast, though, India's population is still largely rural. India's population, urban population is still, or India's population is still largely rural, such that by 2050, only about 52% of the population will be urban. So today in China, more people live in urban areas than in rural, but in India, the rural population still dominates. So it's, like I said, it's going to be a while before both of these countries are going to have a small fraction of their population in rural places.
Yeah. Before they have anything to worry about in terms of food production or whatever.
Well, yes. And I think the other thing that we're seeing in China very rapidly, especially in the countryside, is significant shifts in agricultural production. And we see more economies of scale in agricultural production and more mechanized farming. And so we're going to see a lot more gains in efficiency and also just less of the population needed for agricultural production.
Yeah, much like what happened in the U.S. 75, 100 years ago that drove people off farms.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, in fact, if you look across the OECD European countries, you'll see that there's a very strong correlation between economic development and the percentage of the population that is engaged in farming. I mean, one of the things that is a little bit different today in terms of urbanization is that whereas in the past, urbanization and industrialization, economic growth were all quite parallel each other, today we see in some places a decoupling between the urbanization process and economic development. And we really see that in places like in continents like in Africa, where urbanization rates are increasing, but economic development is relatively stagnating.
I want to get into what urbanization looks like on the ground in a minute, but I'm wondering, when you sit back, and you look from Yale, and we're all looking here from America at a world that is very quickly urbanizing, what worries you, even if the places that are most quickly urbanizing are not right here in our backyards?
A couple of different things worry me. I mean, one is that I think from a North American perspective, we have very little understanding of what global patterns of urbanization means for planetary sustainability and also what it means for just us here as Americans living in the U.S. When we think about the scenario that you brought up earlier, 5 billion urban people, those are 5 billion people that require food. Require shelter, concrete, steel. Those are the folks who want iPads and iPods. And that has going to exact a huge demand on the Earth's resources. There are also a lot of, obviously, benefits from urbanization. I mentioned earlier in terms of innovation and benefits in terms of economic development, sanitation, and education, especially for women. And I think one of the big challenges moving forward is how those opportunities and challenges will be balanced. That's something that I wouldn't say worries me, but certainly is something that will be interesting to take a look at in the years to come. I think from a planetary perspective, moving away from speaking as someone sitting in North America, I mean, I think the question about resources is a big one, whether it's the amount of food that's going to be required to feed an urban population. We know that urban dwellers have a very different diet. I have a doctoral student here at Yale who's been looking at some of the dietary shifts in Chinese cities, and one of the things that she has found is that people in cities with the same income level eat a very different diet than people in rural places, again, at the same income level. So people in Chinese cities tend to eat more dairy. They eat more meat and more processed foods. And we know that meat products and dairy products also have a larger impact on the environment than grains and vegetables.
So people literally, once they start being absorbed by the urban surroundings, they literally become part of that, and they become different people in some sense than the people that they were in a rural area.
Yes, I mean, it's a very, some of these relationships and causalities are very difficult to tease out, right? So the person who has the same income level in a rural place versus an urban place, but very different lifestyles, how much can we say is due to urbanization, due to that person being in a city? Those are factors that are very difficult to tease out. But what we're finding is that there are very different availabilities and exposure of food types in cities. And this is not just in China, but also in India. India has one of the fastest growing levels of rates of diabetes, and primarily in the cities. We see that people who live in cities have a very different lifestyle, and as you said, you know, some of that is because people are, as you were saying, being absorbed into the cities, but also that they're just simply being exposed to very different options. I mean, the other big, I think, concern at the global planetary scale is what urbanization means for energy use. As people move to cities and people in cities have a very different energy profile than people in the countryside. There's some research that shows that people in cities climb up what is called the energy ladder. They move from using traditional fuels and wood fuels to higher forms of energy, so ultimately towards electricity and other electricity and gas and such. So that's the other big question is, you know, 5 billion people, many of who will eventually own private motor vehicles, will live in bigger houses, means more places to heat, more places to cool, very different diets. I mean, it's going to be a challenge because there are a lot of benefits of urbanization socially and also environmentally, but there are going to be also huge environmental challenges.
When you talk about a draw on resources, whether you're talking about people wanting iPhones or iPads, or you're talking about concrete and steel, what do you see coming? I mean, do you see a real struggle over, well, who gets, you know, the steel that they need and the concrete that they need and the precious minerals that they need?
Well, I think we're seeing some of this play out already in terms of clampdowns in China and other places on critical metals and limited resources. I think, though, the picture is not so bleak. I mean, I wouldn't say that as we move to a world with 5 billion urban dwellers that we're all scrambling for limited resources. I mean, I think one of the real benefits of urbanization is a move towards more efficient use of resources, be it of housing resources, of energy. I mean, a lot of the research shows that on a per capita basis, people certainly in North America and OECD countries in cities on per capita basis use less energy than national averages. So if you look at, let's say, the average New Yorker or the average person in Hong Kong or Tokyo or in London will emit less carbon per capita and also use less energy per capita than national averages. So there are a lot of opportunities to be gained. I think one of the big challenges moving forward is what types of cities will emerge? You know, what are these going to be places where you and I will want to live? Are they livable, culturally vibrant, exciting places? There's a reason why many of us, or most of us around the world, live in cities.
Another question about comparing sort of the industrialized world with the world that is rapidly industrializing. As we have industrialized in the U.S. and in other places, Japan, birth rates have gone down as people urbanize generally. Now, I wonder, is that a sort of mitigating factor, something that's going to be helpful in China or in India or even more broadly Africa? Because as people come into the city, they don't have as much space and they don't have as big families. And that's helpful in terms of carbon footprint.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the big opportunities for women when they move into cities is education. But the other are a lot of health benefits and opportunities via sanitation and also a lot more economic opportunities, which also brings down the birth rates.
So let me ask you, let's go on the ground in China, because I know you've really looked at urbanization in China, and you've particularly looked at this place called the Pearl River Delta. Where is that, and what has happened to it over the past few decades?
The Pearl River Delta is situated in South China, just across the border from Hong Kong, and it is a region that really was one of the first places where the Chinese government undertook economic reforms, and it was really a laboratory for the government. And recently, the various governments that make up the Pearl River Delta, the various city governments and also at the provincial level, discussed the possibility of a Pearl River Delta megacity. And this Pearl River Delta megacity would cover an area that's about 16,000 square miles. And just
wow.
To give you a comparison, London is only 600 square miles.
So what does it do either to the local environment or even to the planetary environment when you basically take asphalt and just put it over that kind of tremendous area as you were describing?
Well, there's a lot of research now that from around the world that shows that urbanization has a signal on the local and regional climate. And some research is now showing that urbanization has a global climate signal as well. But on the local or regional side, I mean, you can just imagine, just think of agriculture or forests as being sponges, right? I mean, there's soil there. There's live soil that absorbs water. And certainly has an effect on the local hydrological cycle, affects rainfall patterns, affects the local energy balance in terms of the temperature locally. And as you pave over these places, they think about them as sponges, it completely shifts the local energy balance, you know, the amount of reflectivity that's in the landscape, the amount of buildings and materials that absorb energy, whether it's energy from the sun or energy from running an air conditioner or even just energy from like cars. And so the built environment absorbs a lot of energy, and that fundamentally shifts the regional climate. And there's emerging research that shows that has also an impact not only on the temperatures, the daytime and nighttime temperatures, but also on precipitation patterns, on rainfall patterns. In some parts of the world, we're seeing evidence that urbanization results in an increase in a rainfall in the nearby areas, primarily due to increases in clouds and cloud cover, due to aerosols, possibly. In other places, we're seeing that urbanization leads to a decline in rainfall. But whatever the mechanism is, it's clear that paving over vegetated areas does have an impact on both temperature and on rainfall. And the other really obvious impact of urbanization is the loss of vegetation and loss of habitat. And that will have significant impact on species worldwide as we move to a world with 5 billion people. I mean, one of the interesting things about urbanization today versus urbanization in the past is, you know, cities in the past represented compact living. You know, when we think about cities, they were dense, they were compact. A lot of cities were really walkable. But today what we're seeing is that cities may be compact, they may be dense, but they're also really spread out. So they're growing up, they're expanding, you know, high rises, but they're also expanding out. And so, for example, what we're seeing, what we will see in the first three decades of the 21st century is a tripling of the amount of urban land cover. So think of all the urban land cover on the planet in 2000 and triple that by 2030.
And even now, when you think about carbon footprint, there's been a lot of research that a tremendous amount of the transportation fuel that's burned in cities is just people not going anywhere, just people looking for a parking space.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's the new city of the late 20th century, is the city that isn't walkable or bikeable, or, you know, the city that, I mean, in many ways it is the antithesis of what we think of a city. I mean, when we think of the cities that people go to on vacation are usually the cities where there's a lot of mixed land uses, a lot of interesting things to see in a short distance. You can walk to A and B and C, and if you can't walk, you can get to these places via alternative modes of transportation, bus or maybe taxi, or maybe it's a scooter, or maybe it's some kind of mass rapid transit. And today we see cities that are, again, dense, but many of which actually you need to get in a car to get to A and B, and there are really limited types of transportation.
Now, how good are the new cities? You know, how much are the people in China, India, Africa learning from you know, Western countries in terms of, well, this way that you plan the city, not that efficient. You know, we could do something better. I mean, I have been on Shanghai's mass transport, their subway. It's pretty darn good. I mean, it's very clean, very fast, very efficient. Are new cities that are growing up incorporating a more environmentally friendly way of doing things?
Yes and no. So the good news is there's more of awareness. I mean, every policymaker I've spoken to in China and India, there's awareness of trying to build a green city, of environmental sustainability. That's the good news. The bad news is that, going back to your earlier question, is there is a lot of replicating bad ideas. And there's a lot of following patterns of urban development that we know here in North America are not sustainable. The kind of low density, car driven, single family home, detached housing, zoning where people live really far from where they work. I mean, those are all things that we know now lead to a lot of energy use through transport and a lot of emissions. And it also leads to segregations of communities, people feeling spending a lot of time in cars, where it exacts a health impact as well. There are studies that show that living in places where you're in a car all the time really has a negative impact on health. But so the bad news is that a lot of cities in primarily in China are really replicating these car friendly or car oriented type of development. I mean, it is one of the ironies that Chinese cities are very dense. They're incredibly dense, but they're also very spread out, and so that they're not really very accessible. Now, Indian cities are very different. I mean, if you go to some of the largest cities in India, they actually won't feel like they're really big cities because Indian cities aren't growing up so much. I mean, if you go to Delhi, if you go to Kolkata, Chennai, Bangalore, these cities are cities where there aren't a lot of high rises, but they are spreading out. You'll see a lot of 4 or 5 story buildings, but they're very expansive.
But that seems like it would be very inefficient.
Yes, it seems like it's inefficient, but it also depends on how these cities are designed. I mean, if you look at Manhattan, I mean, Manhattan as a borough of New York is actually, it actually is designed around or is configured around a number of different pretty unique neighborhoods. So even though you know, all of New York City, if you count all the boroughs, is quite big. I mean, your daily life, where you live and where you work, is probably centered around just a few neighborhoods. I mean, I think Boston's a good example where, you know, Boston and Cambridge, that, you know, greater area, certainly is really built around a lot of different neighborhoods and with really great transport. And so the issue is not only how big these cities get in terms of the total space, but also the types of neighborhoods that emerge within these cities.
It's really interesting that you mentioned Boston, because I think you're right about the sort of crucial nature of transportation in all of this and the ability to get around easily. And it's interesting to me that you said that the Chinese government is maybe not as careful as they could be about making sure that people don't spend all their time in their car being environmentally friendly, because we hear from people like Tom Friedman from the New York Times that the Chinese government does realize that that people are sort of choking literally on the fumes of this incredible rapid urbanization. You know, that in Beijing and Shanghai, that these are very unhealthy environments to live in sometimes, but that doesn't seem to be fully translating into, okay, then this is how we build our cities.
Well, I mean, I think one of the big myths about urban development is that the planner, the planning office designs the city and then the city emerges. And I think that's also one of the myths about Chinese urbanization, is that people think, well, because it's very much still a top-down society, that whatever Beijing or whatever the mayor says is going to be what happens. But in fact, around the world, cities are developed in a piecemeal, still eclectic fashion, and there are a lot of different actors involved. I mean, this is one of the big worrisome things about the current pace of urbanization, is that given the long life and really near irreversibility of infrastructure, it's going to be really critical for current urbanization-related policies to really consider the long-lasting impacts of road development, of highways, of subways. But, you know, I do want to say that it's not all doom and gloom, because there is really an enormous opportunity in the next 2 to 3 decades. I mean, we did some estimates that showed that over the next 3 decades, every single day, the urbanization rate is equal to 20,000 American football fields becoming urban every single day for the first 3 decades of this century. So 20,000 American football fields getting paved every day for 30 years is an enormous opportunity to shape how these built environments and cities will become.
So are there cities, are there places, countries maybe, that you think are doing it right, that you could point to and say, this is a really interesting example of how this area urbanized?
So that's the question that I get asked probably the most, is what place does it right? And the answer I usually give is, I think there's no one place that's getting it all right. And I think especially if you look at these rapidly urbanizing cities, they're really different from the places that are often put on a pedestal or heralded as the greenest, most environmentally sustainable cities. I mean, if you look at any of those lists often include cities like Copenhagen, where I lived for a while, Stockholm, sometimes they include Portland, Oregon, or New York City, Barcelona. I mean, they're invariably cities that, one, don't have very large populations, B, are not rapidly growing, and have economies that are primarily services, you know, in service economies. So those are really different cities with very different development histories and development futures than places like Shenzhen, like Shanghai, like Bangalore, that are rapidly urbanizing.
So, you know, if you're sitting in the U.S. listening to a story of rapid urbanization, but it's not really happening here so much, What should the American government, what should the American people be looking for as this incredible urbanization unfolds over the next 20, 30 years?
Well, I think one of the things we could do, and this goes back to the earlier discussion about countries like China and India following North American models. And I think one of the things that we can do is lead by example, that there are many efforts in this country, many efforts by cities, mayors that are very innovative in terms of thinking about redeveloping their cities, redeveloping and encouraging more economic activity in cities, infilling so that people can live in cities, rezoning so that people can be living close to where they work, incentives to bring industry back into the cities, making cities more vibrant places so that they, you know, really reversing the trend of hollowing out cities and people moving into the suburbs. And I think that's certainly one of the things that other countries will look for is example from the United States. I mean, I'm amazed when I go overseas how many places, how many offices I go to where, you know, they've got planning 101 planning 101 books that are literally lifted from, you know, American planning. And so there is so much that we can do by leading really through example.
And are there some cities that you would point to here in the U.S. that you think follow the model of what you're of what you just mentioned, that are trying to infill the areas that are not being used efficiently, that you might point a developing country to and say, take a look at what they're doing?
Okay, so I'm going to be biased here, Kara, because I live in New Haven, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, New Haven is a good example of a city that was a manufacturing city, and it's shifting, and it's been trying to figure out what its marginal advantage is regionally, within the state, nationally, and what the city has done, what's it's partnered with Yale. What the city's done is, I think, over the last 30 years, a remarkable job at bringing more jobs into the city, commercial activity into the city, more housing into the city. It's many parts of the city. Again, it's also based on neighborhoods. Many parts of the city are incredibly walkable. I live 1 mile from where I work, so most days I bike or walk. Sometimes I scooter, but I'm not very good at that. So, I mean, it's a very accessible place, and that creates a certain type of community. And it really can create a very vibrant, culturally rich, economically interesting, vibrant a place to live. Now, density wise and size wise, you know, New Haven is like a small town in India and China. But I think some of these principles can certainly be scaled up to cities of 1 and 5 million. I mean, at the end of the day, I lived in San Francisco for many years. And when I lived in San Francisco, most of my life and my activities really centered around my neighborhood. You know, I didn't, I wasn't really experiencing my life, you know, throughout the entire city. I mean, just like, again, in Boston and Cambridge, it's unlikely that you're really using all different geographies of the cities. You're very likely to experience just one or two different neighborhoods in your city.
But that's what you want, right? You really want that proximity of where you live and where you work and not having to separate them. Ideally.
Right. I mean, that's that co-location is critical. And when I lived in California, there was a part when I wasn't living in San Francisco and I had to get in a car for everything. And I think one of the things that we want going into the future are cities where people do have access to the kind of civic amenities, commercial amenities. And we get those accessibility through mixed land use and also co-location of different services and different activities.
And a final question for you, is there anything in developing cities that you have visited where you thought, this is a fascinating innovation and I would love to see this in the U.S., whether we're talking a monorail, whatever it is, something that was really innovative that you've seen out there?
Hands down, I would say energy use in buildings. Many government buildings in China that I've been in, and also residential buildings, seem to be very smart about how they're using energy. So whether they're smart buildings or whether they're motion detecting light, it seems that even something really simple like escalators. I mean, we hear, you know, you go to a department store and those escalators are just running nonstop, regardless of whether anybody's using them. And every time I go to Asia and I see those escalators that only operate when someone is on them, I think, why don't we have that back home?
Hmm.
Or a really simple thing that's not only in Asia but is pretty popular, common in Europe is switches on the wall where, you know, the plug has a little switch that actually turns off when you're not using it. There are lots of little savings that I feel like, wow, why don't we have that back home? The other really big thing that's hands down when you go to Asia, especially these newly developed cities in Asia, their public transportation is incredible. I mean, you go to Taipei, you go to Shanghai, Delhi, I mean, they have great public transportation systems. They're very clean. They're efficient. The airports, I mean, it's a sad thing, but when I come back to the U.S. and I land in pick any airport in the U.S. almost, it seems like I'm actually coming back to a developing country because the infrastructure, the facilities are certainly not at the same level that they are in some of these rapidly urbanizing, rapidly developing places.
Yeah, the gleaming airports and train stations. Karen Seto, Associate Professor at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks, Kara.
And stay tuned as the conversation continues here on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.